Welcome, everybody. This is the Liver Lineup Updates and Unfiltered Insights. You've got Nancy Rowe and Kim Brown as your co-hosts, and we have two wonderful guests, Dr. Saul Carpent and Dr. Robert Gish, and I'm going to let them tell you a little bit about themselves. I'll start with you, Saul.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Nancy and Kim. It's a delight to do this. So I'm Saul Carpen. I'm a pediatric hepatologist. I live in Richmond, Virginia. My main interests in lab life has been in cholestasis and figuring things out for different genes and biliary atresia and the like and certain therapies. And this year, I'm really privileged to serve as the ASLD president.
Yeah, I can see all the merch there in the background. And Bob, how about you?
Hi, I'm Robert Gish. I'm based in San Diego, an adult hepatologist who often bows to Saul Carpen for my cholestasis questions. We'll get to that later. I practice in a number of different clinical settings. One is a federal clinic, one rural clinic, one multi-specialty group, and one GI group as their designated hepatologist. And I teach at three different universities, UCSD, Loma Linda, and University of Nevada. So I'm very happy to be here, Nancy and Kim. Saul, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this dynamic discussion.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both. And Kim, I'm going to admit that this is a very selfish, podcast on my part, because one of the things that I feel that my learning curve is zero is understanding the cholestatic genetic test that I order and then get back and cannot interpret. And despite ordering lots of them, I feel that I have gotten no better. It's kind of like Spanish. I'm not doing very well at that either. So I think that we have some questions for you, and I can't promise to be any smarter, but I at least will have maybe an excuse as to why I don't understand the cholestasis tests that I'm ordering.
Yeah, I agree. When we thought about this podcast, I think as adult hepatologists, we're using these tests more and more, but not understanding how to use them actually. So maybe I'll start off, Saul, since you are experienced as a pediatric hepatologist and an expert in cholestasis, tell me a little bit about how long you've been using genetic testing, particularly for cholestatic disease, and how it has helped you in your practice.
No, Kim, that's really the right answer. I don't promise to reveal all, because it ain't going to happen. Okay. So, but I am going to hopefully clear away some of the fog and make you feel more comfortable is really what I think is the right approach. And Bob can really help with that when he talks about his approaches. So I actually, in pediatrics, we always think about genetics because we think kids are pristine. And then when something bad happens, it's got to be something genetic, right? It can't be anything environmental. And so we do think genetic. And I'm old enough to have lived through the era where we actually did things like a biopsy and took a piece of tissue and then did some biochemical tests. And then we waited 2 months and had an indeterminate answer for one gene. What we learned from the Human Genome Project is that there are 19,000 genes. So, it really was this diagnostic odyssey that was horrific for everybody involved. And then starting about 10 years ago, it became apparent that you didn't have to do gene sequencing one by one. The modern era started about 10 years ago, where you could look at all genes all at once. And you don't want to look at all 3 billion nucleotides. You don't care about that. You just want to look at the coding regions, which is the definition of what an exome is. None of us were trained to know what this stuff means. The newer generation, Earth Alert, is they're no better than we are of hepatologists. So just think that you can ask a younger colleague this, may be beneficial, but sadly, this is self-learning. And it's not a big hill to climb. I think, Nancy, you undersell yourself. I'm sure you understand this, and I'm sure you know this. But there are some easy guidelines with it. When I moved to Emory a bit ago, there was a very robust gene diagnostic lab there. And I said, hey, can we make a cholestasis panel? I had a great partner in the genetics group there, and we made it. So we made the first genetic panel. We put together a list of genes that we knew. I mean, the first cholestasis gene was cloned in 1998. So we have 25 plus years of information on the big three. And those are really things, if that's an outcome of this call in the adult world, when I talk to adult hepatologists, I want you to know the big two. Okay. And then so it ain't that bad after that. So we realized that there were a lot of things that we say, look, if we're going to look for genes, it's just as easy to put a few dozen on there as it is to put two or three. That's silly to do that. So that's where we expanded it and set up the first cholestasis panel, which was great. And it was called the Emory panel at that point because Emory ran it. Then Emory was bought and then bought again and this and that. And what we didn't know was that at the same time, the world of therapies for genetic cholestasis was happening simultaneously. And so that happened because of the IBAT inhibitor world. And I'm in that world a bit too. And so because of that, it ended up being that one of the companies who were looking at that, and also a company that was involved in therapies for a very rare form of pediatric liver disease for bile acid synthesis defects, said, you know what? We have so much trouble identifying these patients. Maybe if we let people use this existing panel, do it. And they actually set up a wonderful service to have a free way to look for genetic forms of cholestasis because we put on the synthesis defects as well as these genetic forms of cholestasis. Okay. So that started the process. And once it became freely available and done by a good lab, and then now is done by another fantastic lab, it ends up being that it became part of the culture of pediatrics to incorporate this in your workup. So now it's part of the fabric. So to sort of give a little bit of history just to say that why is it slightly different in the PD world as opposed to what we're working on now with three of you? And I think it's slightly different in mindset. As pediatricians, I've learned, and I now work in an internal medicine department, so I get some of this, is we're okay with a 10% hit rate. Like, that's a success. You're not okay in the adult world with a 10% hit rate. Like, that is, I'm wasting 90% of my time. And so we're fine with that because it's a 0% hit rate otherwise. And then we're making lifelong diagnoses. The last thing I would mention with the panels is, in general, it's a one and done for those genes, meaning I thought the person could have this or that. Now there's no variance in that gene. I don't ever have to think about that ever again. And I find that quite comforting. Now the panels from the two companies that are being supported also includes a lot more liver disease that is relevant to adult hepatology. Includes Wilson disease, HFE, other ones. And so I find that quite helpful. But you know, when your menu is really big, you're going to start to get a lot of hits that you don't know. And I think that that's the frustration that Nancy first started with. And then I can help, hopefully, during the course of this podcast, help with some of that frustration.
Yeah, thank you. That's great background.
Yeah, and it's incredible to think 25 years you've been doing genetic testing. So I guess I'm a little behind. I will learn from the noise and realize that if only 10% of the time a pediatrician gets an answer that they're happy with, then I can sit on my hands and be well behaved. And I did as for what not foreclosure, but in anticipation of this, I had Chinese for lunch, and my fortune said, a skill learned this week will soon prove valuable. So I'm hoping for a lot from this. So I think that you now say that this is a fabric in the pediatrician's, toolbox that they're using all the time. What would you tell an adult hepatologist as to when we should use this? Because once patients know that their genes can be tested, sometimes they're requesting some, testing. For example, I put into the questions I was going to ask you about, would you think of a reason to test someone that you suspect has Gilbert's? Because I've had a couple of parents request testing for their, adolescent children, and I have gotten some of that noise back, and I suspect I've gotten Gilbert's plus, but you know, in the past I wouldn't have done it. So I, as an adult hepatologist, am often ordering these when I have unexplained cholestasis, so that AMA negative PBC, especially if you're younger. I have more extreme cholestasis. So I have someone who's got intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy that doesn't get better from that, you know, or I have a young person that I just can't figure it, or a person I can't figure out. And then I'm like, well, maybe it could be this. But I suspect that that's a test that I'm using in desperation and not with a lot of forethought.
I can maybe answer a little bit, but Bob's here to can really tell you about all what he thinks is good for the adult hepatologist. I think it's worthwhile, a little bit of the mechanics of the panel is worthwhile knowing, because you asked about a specific disease like Gilbert. Unfortunately, they report rare variants that are present in 40% of the population. So you're always going to get a bit of a hit in almost every panel. So some of this was added. We didn't put in Gilbert, by the way, so someone else added that. I do not accept responsibility for that. And so, because it is a lot there. As far as using this for that purpose, I mean, I'm grateful that companies support this, but they also know that we're trying to do this for cholestasis. But there's also reasons why you can't explain a mixed hyperbilirubinemia. And there really are patients there, and you do need, and then you get that, right? You know, for it. So I think it's a bit helpful, the Gilbert one. The other bits are there's a number of other genes there that are very highly annotated, which means that they will generate a report because somebody's looked for variants in that gene. And the number one gene there is CFTR. So often you get reports and you say, wait a second, I wasn't thinking about CF in this patient. I mean, wow. And the answer is unlikely unless you had some other, you know, reason. Don't say no, but it's really the report itself. Some of these things are very visual because you get some scripted answers that we're not used to, such as pathogenic, likely pathogenic, variant of unknown significance, likely benign, and benign. And the companies that do genetic testing are only allowed those five answers. So they each have a specific meaning that you could figure out, right? You know, somebody reported it, it's benign. Somebody reported this, you know, alpha 1 variant, that's the number one alpha 1 variant, as pathogenic, that's pathogenic, right? So that's it. The thing that gets everybody is the variants of unknown significance, which we can perhaps have time to talk about later. But so those are answers that are going to be helpful. But Bob, you're the one who needs to answer the question about how useful this is for adults.
Yeah, Bob, that's it's great to have this background because really, you know, we as adult hepatologists, the vast majority of us, maybe except for Bob, don't really understand this. But Bob, you know, help us understand, you know, who, number one, who are you testing? Who are you using these genetic panels for? Where do you think it's valuable? And I guess one of the questions I have is, did the pediatricians find everybody, or do some of those people wander into adulthood and we have to find them? So help us out here.
Thanks a lot for having me and give you a little bit of context. I've ordered over 80 of these panels. Probably of those 80, 75 were from Prevention Genetics. I just started ordering the Invitae panel. And my general rule is unexplained liver disease. I just don't think unexplained cholestatic liver disease. I think also because some of the patients have an AST and ALT dominant picture, I'm just going to use it as an overarching theme. I agree very much with Saul that the hit rate is high. Out of these 80 tests, over 70 have had two or more variants. We don't use the word mutation anymore. We use the word variants. And then I look at those variants and try to come back to the patient's clinical profile to decide how to interpret those. So I would start by saying, as you said, AMA negative PBC, that would be a place. I would say somebody who's got lean NASH, especially if they've got lean fatty liver with itch. I'm saying MASH, not necessarily NASH, but lean NASH is carried over. Any atypical biliary laboratory abnormality, high alk phos, normal GGT. That's something that also triggers you to make you think about one of these PFIC variants. I think there's 11 out of many of them that have been described that have high alk phos, normal GGT. And I could go down drug-induced cholestasis. That could be birth control, herbal, so dilly, hilly, silly, chilly. Any of the four that are in those families, I will be doing these mutations or variants assessments. There's a number of other settings, but I think those are the most common, including intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. I just had a patient on the line literally 2 minutes before I got on this call. A young woman, she's Gravida 2, Para 1, 31 years of age. Had classic ICP during her third trimester, very high liver enzymes, and did not have to have an early termination, but was being monitored very closely. A lot of itch, high alk phos, as well as enzymes. Bile acids, though, were only mildly elevated. I think her peak bile acids in the third trimester were 34, which is at least good news for the baby. She ended up having, interestingly, two different variants. She has ABCB4, which is PFIC3. That's the MDR3 variant. And that's been associated with intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy. She also had what's called CYP7A1, and that is a cholesterol metabolism enzyme that is involved in making bile acids. So if you are missing this enzyme, you're going to have low bile acids or not necessarily super high bile acids and may have hypercholesterolemia, which she does. Her cholesterol is slightly high, and she's now just entering into or heading towards her third trimester. She had a spike in her AST and ALT at week 16, came back down without treatment. She's not on Urso. So I think she's got two variants that are both been associated with liver disease, both been associated with cholestatic liver disease. And we're watching her very closely as she's entering her third trimester. I didn't put her on Urso yet. Maybe Saul can make a comment because all of her liver tests went back to normal. Enzymes function, direct bilirubin, and her bile acids also bumped just a little bit, but now they're back below 10. So very useful. And she and I were negotiating. We monitor liver tests weekly or every 2 weeks, every 4 weeks. We decided on every 4 weeks, bile acids every 4 weeks, and walk her through. So literally this afternoon, fantastic case that really fits in with what we're talking about today. I'm going to mention two more cases, both of which I saw today. A woman with severe COPD came into clinic. She's a little bit overweight, had a little bit of fatty liver in her early 70s, had a mild smoking history, and her enzyme pattern were just high. She had a high alk phos, normal GGT, mildly elevated enzymes, sent a genetic panel on her. She's a heterozygote for cystic fibrosis and a heterozygote for alpha-1. So I really think this is why she's got severe lung disease, far out of proportion to smoking, and why I'm trying to get her into UCSD for both the genetics clinic and pulmonary clinic. She's F2 to F3, so we're going to be monitoring her liver status also. I don't know about the utility of Urso in her case, but and then finally, a case earlier today had a PEX mutation, which is associated with the Zellweger syndrome. So we sent off the Zellweger package, which is a bile acid package, a blood test from Mirum. So three cases today, hot off the press. This is my life in hepatology because I'm analyzing the literature and then figuring out what direction to go with their care and management.
I guess that's a great synopsis to why you do it when you're thinking, and it's hard when you get the results, right, Nancy and Kim. I think that that's really the hard part, because we're not exactly trained for it. Plus, when you don't do it all the time, you see somebody say, "Wow, I just found something." So the question of whether is it relevant or not is hard, to figure out. And Bob and I have talked about this with for patients, and I think it's really serious because we can very much overdiagnose patients and scare them and not, you know, with these findings. But we're used to that from other blood tests. So I really think that hepatologists are absolutely should be unafraid of these tests, because you're used to this. You're used to some gray areas with imaging and with other things. I mean, you know, you see a spot on an ultrasound, we have the same worry discussions that you have. So I would put this in almost that same category, that it's okay to not know sometimes, but monitor. But often I look at especially the variants, and this is where people have to dig in and say, yes, you need to know some genetics. And that the thing you need to know is most heterozygotes, meaning if it's just one copy, it's just like their parents had. And it's likely that they're okay. There are some diseases, and Bob brought one of these up, and this is one of the two genes, Nancy, that we're gonna learn during this podcast, is ABCB4. That is the phospholipid transporter. That is the number one gene you need to know about. And so that one, actually, significant mutations in it that have been annotated can cause disease in heterozygotes. And there's a number of papers now, again, since this is one of those early genes diagnosed, that there's information. You could see families where somebody had bad ICP or drug-induced liver injury. Some needed a transplant and some were perfectly fine. And so it's quite frightening when you can have that array of disease with the same genetic mutation. So you still, there are some there, that is the one gene where monoallelic mutations can cause disease. There's two or three really good papers that have talked about this in the last 4 or 5 years in adults, where it ends up being, if you really look at unexplained elevated liver indices, as I'm glad you said that, you don't need to be itchy, you know, unexplained, and the biopsy is unclear, and maybe there's a cholangiopathy here, is that you really want to then look for this particular gene defect, because the heads can respond to URSA. And so that's a clinical finding. So those are rationale to think about this as a disease.
Think about this 31-year-old woman I was just on video with, and I said, tell me a little bit more about your family. And she goes, oh, my grandmother had her gallbladder out and she's got multiple intrahepatic bile duct stones and she's getting an ERCP tomorrow.
Ooh. I mean, this is like often, you know, we see a patient with Alagille syndrome, and then you look at the parents and you say, oh yeah, one of you's got Alagille syndrome. And then has anyone ever seen you? And they may be perfectly fine, by the way, but someone needs to do a genetic test on them to say, is that, and then somebody needs to see them. So I think family history is spot on. I think it's hard when people think in the adult hepatology world that you need to remember all of your associated disease things for pediatric diseases. You're an adult hepatologist for a reason, right? You didn't want to have that as part of your day-to-day life. And that makes sense, but you don't need that. You really need to think about it. And that is one gene. The other gene also Bob mentioned is ABCB11. And the reason these two are the ones that were first cloned and identified is they're the functional bits in the hepatocyte, where one is the gene responsible for putting phospholipids into bile. That's the ABCB4 gene. And if you can't put phospholipids in bile, it's easy for me to remember. I need to understand physiology, that you have bile acids in bile that don't have a counter to it. And then the ABCB11, and that's why, by the way, that gives you a cholangiopathy, a high GGT. The ABCB11 gene is the only way bile acids get from inside the hepatocyte into the duct. So if that gene's not working well, you know bile acids are going to well up in the hepatocyte. So you have more of a hepatocellular bit of damage. And then each of these genes are regulated by states of stress. So pregnancy, actually, you know, severe work, There are things that you've seen these people who get really sick livers when they've been out in the heat and working hard. So there's a number of stressors. Sepsis is number one, two, and three, as far as sepsis-associated cholestasis. So if you already had a variant and you're working at, let's say, 25% of normal function, that's probably fine for day to day. But then you get pregnant, then you start a drug like an OCP, or you get DILI, so then you can start to see someone who's percolating along fine when they get a second hit. That's when it comes.
What if you had a liver transplant? Remember these patients have these prolonged cholestatic patterns after transplant? That, I think, needs to be investigated. I haven't done that yet, but that's another wide open door.
Yeah, Bob, I just wrote down on my little cheat sheet, because what do I want to ask you guys? What kind of results would you get if you did genetic testing on a patient with a liver transplant? I mean, do you get their genes, the new genes?
You need to do a liver biopsy to get the genes of his now new liver.
Yeah, because I suspected that the buccal swab was not going to give me the right answer.
That'll be very confusing. That's why nobody's done it.
Yes. So you brought up something interesting, and that's the cholestasis of sepsis. And I suspect that maybe even our ICU cholestasis, the COVID cholestasis, I wonder if this also is a subset of people we should have probably thought about genetic testing. And I just saw today, a person who has four generations of cirrhosis, presumably from mast cell, even though my patient wasn't that chubby. But that's also, again, probably pulling in maybe that ABCB11, which has the hepatocellular, not the cholestatic presentation, is something that we might be interested in.
There have been some population studies of elevated ALTs and why. It ends up being that these two gene variants show up in that list for populations. Now, could it be 2% of the people? Right. But it's a population. Sepsis alone with normal genes will reduce the expression of these genes during sepsis. So you may have no variants at all, but imagine you started with a variant and then you reduce the expression. That, I think, is a very cogent argument for some patients who have had prolonged bouts of cholestasis after their sepsis is fine, their liver's getting better, but why are they still cholestatic? It makes no sense. And those MASH patients who have a cholestatic phenotype, which has been identified with some more sophisticated spatial transcriptomics and other analyses of later stage MASH, there's a big cholangiopathy for some of these patients, or at least a recognizable one. And so you never know, right? Are these the patients who may also have variants?
Yeah, I think I recall a handful of patients years ago with hepatitis C that looked more cholestatic than they should and had what looked like, bile duct injury with all other additional negative markers. So you two are experts. Do you guys use a geneticist to help you, or how do the rest of us, plebs figure all of this out, other than with a lot of reading and a lot of patient experience? Bob, do you use a geneticist?
I tried and it failed. I sent him to UCSF. I sent him to Stanford. I've tried sending him to UCSD, and they come back with no additional information other than they want to do more testing. I'm not sure what more they're going to do unless they do whole exome sequencing that's non-targeted, or whole genome sequencing. And that's a bit of a fishing trip. But now I am selectively. I had a patient at my Santa Rosa office who had this very weird cholestatic pattern. He was a 62-year-old man, had some cardiovascular disease. And I thought that was a little atypical because he was thin, didn't have the classic profile. And he came back with unmeasurable LALD, lysosomal acid lipase deficiency.
The only patient you have ever found, probably.
Second.
Okay.
The second. I've had two. The first one, unfortunately, died a month later. But anyway, he's at UCSF in genetics, and they have a LAL-D clinic at UCSF. So, and then the person in the clinic called me up and said, "Why did you do this test?" They couldn't figure out why a 62-year-old would have LAL-D, but he's getting infusions, so he may live another decade or more. And this woman with the cystic fibrosis, alpha 1, a dual heterozygote, she's in genetics. So I'm really sending to genetics for targeted issues. And then also another ICP woman who's a wife of one of my GI friends up in the Sacramento area. She's trying to decide on whether she wants to get pregnant again. What's the risk to the baby? There's a lot of questions that I thought a geneticist could help with once I had her clearly profiled. And she also had a PEX. So she had ABCB4 and a PEX mutation. So it's, and I want to bring up this question about this term called synergistic heterozygosity. This is a term that was even covered at the AASLD postgraduate course this year, which I thought was fantastic. And I think that really is the dynamic word to wrap this together. Instead of going down VUS, I told Prevention Genetics and Invitae they shouldn't use VUS. They should just type in the word correlate clinically, and then you start your thinking process, because VUS just sends everybody into a tailspin. So I think there's better ways that they could term this as you're putting pieces. And finally, sorry to wrap this up. Everybody gets a biopsy. Everybody gets an MRCP. Everybody gets bile acids. Obviously, they're already looking at liver enzymes. Everybody gets a total bilirubin, direct bilirubin, because I diagnosed a Dubin-Johnson today. So it's really nice to kind of think about liver function, liver enzymes, the big four pillars. Now the big four pillars of liver function. You've got imaging, elastography as part of that, MRCP, and you've got histology. That's how I wrap this up. And I've been working on my first 50 patients, a manuscript that's 99.9% done. And almost all patients have all of those components, getting ready to submit this for publication. Though that's the type of data we need to teach our colleagues.
Yeah. So, Bob and Saul, I would have to say that if I had a genetic explanation, I wouldn't have gotten a liver biopsy. It's when my cholestatic test comes back unhelpful or a bunch of variants of unknown significance that I'm then considering a biopsy to look for sarcoidosis or whatever I've still missed. Maybe you could help the people listening to the podcast that would, you know, when would you want a biopsy and how are you going to use that information complementary?
Maybe
Saul.
I could just answer, maybe I could just answer or just comment. I think I'm on a, we're not, Bob and I are not exactly aligned on this with the VUSs. And I'll tell you what, which is why it's complicated and it's not meant to be, conversational, but they may be all normal and we just don't know that. So it's very possible because we see these variants that we have just found something that's valid, but that also does require, as Bob says, you need to have some more validation for it. And that's maybe where the biopsy says, because guess what? Let's say that VUS, you look at that biopsy and you say, yeah, this person has a cholangiopathy. I didn't realize it. That needs to be reported. And so you need, the hard part is how that gets reported, because it's almost a catch-22. It goes from a VUS to a likely pathogenic or pathogenic because somebody says it's associated with disease. And it's, this is the official reports from the geneticist. This is coming back to Nancy, when do you use a geneticist? So I'll tell you when I use a geneticist. I use a geneticist that just had a patient yesterday, would have bet that I found something on the panel. Panel was unrevealing. Kid still has liver disease that I can't explain. That needs a whole exome sequencing. Full stop. It's not found on the panel. Kid really has disease. I need to know if it's something else. And again, this is now about 100 some odd genes, not 19,000. And so you get the full one. And in many pediatric places, you may not know this, but some places actually do exome sequencing on nearly everybody who comes in with complex disease. So it's not a boutique consideration in medicine. It's what we dream about, that our patients are going to come in already exomed or whole genomed, and then someone else is going to interpret it for us, and this is part of their package. you know, that somebody else is ill. But we have to be the experts on at least a couple of the genes. And I concur with you, Bob. We need to be the experts. The geneticists look to us for this. There's also some nuance to the report, and there are a few genes that you actually do need to read the report, at least for those specific genes. So, for example, ABCB11 variants, the bile acid transporter one, if you have a chain terminating mutation in one of these, it's actually a risk factor for cancer.
Liver cancer. Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't know that, and it should be in the report. And that's quite different. That's how you monitor this patient differently. You think about this patient. That's where I think I would get a genetics help, you know, to see if they concur with the risk or not. But we use that quite strongly on whether or not a patient should or shouldn't even be considered in the both allele form for an IBAT inhibitor, because an IBAT inhibitor is not going to work if you can't transport bile acids at all. So, and that patient needs to be referred for transplant. Now, this is, again, a pediatric problem. You're never going to see this, most likely. But just to say the power of using this, but I'm not sure if we know anything about risks for cancer yet. And that's what I'm hoping with more information. The other thing with the information you get today in March of 2026 may be different 5 years from now because people do report things. So if you have a patient who still has disease and you said, boy, I sent this panel 2 years ago, there was something that was unclear, I thought maybe, sometimes it's reinterpreted. And you can ask I haven't asked the companies to reinterpret, but I've asked in certain select situations to reinterpret. The data on reinterpretation is actually quite strong. And the first go rounds with some of these neurodevelopmental clinics where they were looking genetically, when they reinterpreted exome panels from 5 years before, they found 25% more assignments. So we're building the ship as we're flying it, right? You know, in some ways, the library is not complete. So those are just some known caveats for patients you're convinced have disease that you just haven't figured out.
One other comment on the biopsy front is because of the epidemic of obesity that we have, it's really hard to tease out how much of this liver enzyme abnormality is fatty liver, how much is what's happening in the biliary tree or the hepatocellular level. The biopsy, if you get two passes with a 16-gauge needle, you can really get a lot of information there about the component. It also gives me a base because everybody's getting elastography. The biopsy shows F1. I've got a kPa of 6.6 or 6.7, really good prognosis. I can communicate that to the patient, give them a high level of security, which I had this lady today who's got five variants, but it's got absolutely minimal fibrosis. You're going to do well long term. We're going to be monitoring you. She left the clinic very reassured. So I really think the biopsy has a major role. I haven't done one in L50 of the first 50 patients, but I think 40 out of the 50 had biopsy information that helped a lot. One of the cases I had was this woman, PBC, on biopsy, AMA positive, history of being 300 pounds, but had lost 150 pounds. So probably had a fatty liver component, had bile acids over 150, itch on a 0 to 10 scale, a 9 on Urso. And we even had tried Solaldepar on her, no effect on the itch at all. And she ended up having three different variants. And I think it included ABCB4, but I have to look that up. She got put on an IBAT inhibitor. Her bile acids went to normal and her itch was gone. Her itch was gone in a week. Her bile acids were normal in 4 weeks. Total miracle. I said, oh my God, this is one of the greatest drugs ever. So there's a lot. It's a big puzzle to put together. It's not quite like hepatitis C where you treat everybody, hepatitis B where you should treat everybody. This is much more complicated, but it makes hepatology exciting.
And, you know, speaking of IBAT inhibitors, I don't even know if there's something new. You know, this is a situation where the pediatricians for once led the way that we figured out, and it really was a way that we not only fixed the itch, and we're figuring this out. It's not the serum bile acids; they're a marker. It's the retained liver bile acids that do it. But on Friday, the FDA announced that they're going to approve and linerixibat for itch for adults with PBC. So
Right.
this is the first. Actually, this is an unbelievably timely podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's the first time that there's an adult trial with an IBAT inhibitor that now is going to lead to FDA approval for itch in PBC.
And I had a patient today, Saul. I tried to write a prescription for linerixibat today. I can't find it anywhere on the web. It's a PBC patient who's allergic to URSO, who got a flare of liver tests on seladelpar, and it's got F3 to F4. I mean, she's got very aggressive disease. Itch is a 9 on a 0 to 10 scale. She's a perfect candidate for linerixibat if I can find it.
I mean, you have to see, well, you know this. If you can make someone stop itching, you're a miracle worker, frankly. It's
Can
miserable.
I ask, Saul? So, what are your thoughts about these IBAT inhibitors? I mean, I know they're approved for itch. What do you think about morbidity, mortality?
So
Morbidity being
what
itch, but
else
what about mortality?
what else goes better? So there are data from the GALA consortium
Right.
that is a consortium run by Benita Kamath and others. It's worldwide. It's got well over, I don't know, like 1,500 Alagille patients. And they really have done some sophisticated analyses where they can match natural history data to those patients who've been put on Miralixabat. That is one of the two approved for this disorder. And growth, there are a number of parameters that seem to get better. So obviously, if you're not transplanted because of itch, you're better off because you have native liver. But other parameters of liver indices and growth seem to be, it's not unique to maralixibat, odevixibat for these disorders. So again, another IBAT inhibitor also seems to have similar things on sleep. I don't know about school functioning or executive functioning. I would be surprised if it doesn't make that better. I mean, if you're feeling better and you're overall, healthier, everything gets better. So
Yeah.
that's our general sense, I would say. But just to know that not everybody responds.
Right.
And so these are for if you respond, and there are some complete responders, meaning that normalize their serum bile acids and normalize their blood tests, but that's not everybody.
Yeah, I thought that data was very interesting regarding the IBATs.
Out of naivety, are the IBAT inhibitors, I know there's more than one, as we've already kind of insinuated, but are they going to be assumed to have similar efficacy? I mean, like if I have an itchy patient, is one better for one person's genetic abnormality than another?
To date, no, we do not know any of that. What we do know is that some people may need more of the drug. Some people may benefit from twice a day dosing as opposed to once. This is what we do as doctors, right? I mean, you figure this stuff out. The beautiful thing about the IBAT inhibitors is that they're non-absorbed medications. I mean, how do we make a liver disease better by blocking an ileal function and not even having it absorbed? I mean, it's like pretty perfect, except for the diarrhea that happens in many of the patients. So it's close to perfect, but those are what's interesting is the kids' colons are fine with this in general. That's not, necessarily your experience. And I think that that's actually an honest approach to how you manage these patients is how you handle their GI things. If 15% of the adult world has IBS as a baseline, and then you put up on an IBAT inhibitor, I can't imagine they're not going to have symptoms. So managing this, I'm curious how you manage this, Bob, and
This woman who had this profound drop in her pruritus and her bile acid levels had had severe constipation and was the happiest she could be on her
no
IBAT.
wonder why you're a miracle worker.
Yeah.
Oh my God. as a, and I've used both odevixibat and maralixibat, and one has a liquid form and one has a granule form, and you just slowly dose increase this, and they get a tachyphylaxis to the bile acids in their colon. I haven't had anybody with unmanageable diarrhea with those, so it's just go low, go slow. And there is a package insert or package point in the each of the IBATs of the risk of elevated liver tests. So Saul was saying non-absorbed, I think it's 2% or something get into the liver, and there's a risk of liver toxicity. But I'll tell the patients under 5% liver toxicity, and you just need to get a liver panel monthly for 3 months to keep them comfortable. Be monitoring them that way anyway.
I mean, that's really wise. Thanks for bringing that up, because that's real. And so the likely story for that is microbial metabolism of bile acids changes the composition. So for those hepatologists who hate genetics and hate bile acids, this is not your podcast. So this is, unfortunately, because this is what you got to think about. And it's very possible that those patients who do have elevated liver indices, and this is speculation, but it's what we all speculate in this world, that they're making more litho or deoxy or other bile acids because this person's microbiome is different from that person's microbiome. And so I think that's more likely, but it certainly could be, you're right, but it could be that, you know, there's some absorption and there's some liver toxicity. We absolutely have seen elevated liver indices on IBAT treatment early on, absolutely, and then can have to adjust doses. So very, very strong and important information if you're going that route.
So once again, everything comes back to the microbiome.
Circle.
Somewhere those microbiome people are just excited. They know that they've won. They just don't know what they've won.
And the bile acid consortium that we all grew up with as medical students in early liver days, right, when ASLD was just bile acids, they've really come full circles. They should be happy, not just with Urso, but now we got three IBAT inhibitors out there. This is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, and now that honestly, there's a reason to know it, right? I think before, I think you were hit over the head with these nuances, you know, years ago and didn't realize why, right? Now there's a rationality. I mean, Nancy and Kim, do you send serum bile acids now more than you did in the past?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I send genetic testing. I send bile acids. It does seem like every patient that has been a conundrum to me, I'm like, well, maybe we should do some genetic testing, because there are some patients, you know, Bob, you've described a handful that you, with a biopsy, with laboratory testing, with everything, just have never been able to sort out and how best to help them. So
maybe I could ask a question about testing for bile acids, because they are food dependent. So are you particular in getting them in the fasted or the fed state?
The faster.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to do it, I mean, I'm lucky in kids, at least the infants, you know, they're always eating, so what the heck? So it's fine. Some adults too, I guess. But the idea is, I think actually we're not worried about the nuance of an 8 versus a 15. You want to see if it's 50, 40, at least at the moment. We don't know what to do with those values. Normal is, let's say, up to 10. I don't know what to do with, you know, 10 to 20. You know, is someone shunting a little bit? Is this and that? You know, so those are things, but you care more about the higher values is my general sense. But I want to hear from, you know, as this gets rolled out by many more people, that may not be true.
And eating in
cutoff, Bob?
Sorry, Kim?
Oh, I was just asking, you know, do you have a cutoff for when you worry about bile acids?
Yeah, I'm very similar to Saul. I mean, normal fasting should be less than 6. And I've got some people that are 1, 2, or 3 for the components. And order a bile acid panel, not total bile acids. I think that's super important, because you get total bile acids there anyway. In the 10 to 20 range, that's what you see after people eat. And probably in that 30 to 40 range, it's not going to be pathogenic. but it goes back to correlating clinically.
Yeah, and that you'd pay attention to. We find it helpful. Obviously, on medication, it's helpful. That's one thing, but I find that helpful. The other thing I wanted to bring up maybe is another advantage of the genetic panel, just to sort of get back to the beginning, is not just making a diagnosis, but also stopping some other things from being diagnosed. Like I have undiagnosed Wilson disease.
Yeah.
So it can really, because in that disease, you accrete copper, and then if you look for it, then you find it. And so I saw a patient, and this was a teenager who was unresponsive to chelation. The reason was that they didn't have Wilson disease. They actually had a ABCB4 deficiency.
Wow.
So, and it could look, if you don't think about it, you can find it. So I find these really helpful as kind of tags to the patient as through their course.
Both panels, Prevention Genetics and Invitae, have the Wilson disease variant or gene mutations on the panel. What I'm trying to extract from both companies is how deep did they go? I mean, there's over 400, some people say 700, maybe 400 variants that have some level of pathogenicity with Wilson disease. I can't answer that today. I'm trying to extract that.
Yeah, and that's a disease that you can't just rely on genetics, as everybody knows, so don't let that drive the bus. It's one more piece of information.
And a liver biopsy.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm, yeah, we've not gotten rid of histology.
Can I talk about itch for one minute?
Yeah,
You
absolutely.
could, because we're in this bile acid world, we're advocating bile acids to be one of the four pillars of liver function that you can get easily on a lab test. But bile acids probably account or explain or attributed to the itch. And my impressions, maybe half of these patients. We've got this IL-31 that's a hot topic. I just saw that on a TV ad for eczema. We have an IL-31 blocker. I'm going, what is this? I'm sitting in a bus somewhere watching, or I don't remember where it was. It was like weird. And then, of course, we've got this autotaxin lysophosphatidic acid pathway. I've got some patients I put on primrose oil, which interferes with lysophosphatidic acid metabolism. Their itch is gone. Just taking an over-the-counter herbal flower extract. So there's a lot going on in the itch world, and people shouldn't just be in one track now because we have, bile acids and IBAT inhibitors.
Yeah, evening primrose oil is one of the things that I can't remember who in my fellowship passed that on, and that was a long time ago. But yeah, when you didn't have very many things in your at your fingertips, that was one that we would pull out. But so Saul, I know that we need to wrap up a little bit, but I thought you insinuated there were three genes I was going to learn about, and I only have two on my cheat
Yeah,
sheet.
I think we've clouded
Okay.
heads with enough on that,
Okay.
because the third one is really nuanced and I think less easy to remember than those two. So yes, can we stick with two, Nancy? I know
Absolutely
you
can.
want to show you're an achiever,
I
but
am. I have at least achieved something beyond where I was before this podcast. So I'm happy.
Nancy, the panels have 143 variants.
I know 142 of them. I don't understand, but now it's
So
only
let
141. So,
me blow your mind a little bit. So each of us, if we did whole exome sequencing, each of us have 300 genes that have altered function, each of us. Okay, so you're gonna find stuff.
yep. And my family would say that explains everything.
Yeah, but they think that they're pristine, Nancy, and you can remind them that they too have
They too
300
from
plus.
me.
So now I have a genetic reason that I can't learn a foreign language. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I have the
Me
same gene. Yes.
too. And then Bob, you seem to have given the adult doctors a very nice understanding of who we should test. Do you want to try to summarize that just very quickly? Saul's given me only two genes. And do you want to like help the podcast listener to do not, always do genetic testing in this phenotype or
I think that this umbrella term, unexplained chronic liver disease, especially if it has a cholestatic pattern, especially if the GGT is normal, but these others we talked about, lean mash with an itch, dilly, hilly, silly, chilly, you know, drug-induced liver disease, super important, intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, small duct PSC, a third of those have sprue, a third will develop PSC, and a third of those have one or more of these genetic variants that I think is clearly associated with their bile duct disease. Let's see, what else did we leave out in there? We talked about intrahepatic stones. That's obviously super important. Early complicated gallstone disease should be on that list. What else am I leaving out, Saul? We just have it's less than 11. I'll just say that.
No, and maybe you said this with the small duct PSC, but you know, PSC without IBD at all anywhere to my mind, you got to look for this.
Great point.
Well, I've learned a lot. I don't know about you, Kim, but I feel learned actually so smarter. Much.
I was very excited to have the two of you on because I think this is going to be really beneficial for our listeners to start their learning process anyway.
Yeah. And I'm sure ASLD will offer a course for when you feel that this you are ready for more mastery. You can get started on, you know, learning even more. But until then, I think this has been a great, you know, introduction into how to test, not to get too overwhelmed by the results and what to actually look for. Thank you.